Talk given Sunday, 10th February, 1974. With the growth of insight into truth in the religious sense, there is a dispelling of illusions. When we are moved by various causes, our own sorrow or frustration, or our own dissatisfaction with life as it is, with the state of the world, whether the cause which moves us is painful or purely altruistic, when we take to religion through any one or more of these causes, it is almost impossible to avoid the deepest illusion with which we are beset, namely, that I, the person who am turning to the religious life, shall strive for the kingdom of heaven, for nirvana, for perfection, for holiness, for liberation, and so on. This is a fundamental illusion. I, the person, can only strive for worldly ends, because the whole concept of I, the person, the isolatively self-conscious individual, I, the person, am the embodiment of all worldliness. And as long as that consciousness is there of I, the person, as separate from the totality, the reality, as long as that consciousness is there, everything that is of the nature of worldliness, which is of the nature of confining me to the life of the organism as an animal, howsoever good, will hold me in bondage. Do try and awake to this inwardly. The consciousness of I, the isolated person, makes me work for peace, for harmony, for virtue, for the service of mankind, the betterment of conditions, and so on, in the very way which has brought into being the disharmony of the world and of myself, the confusion in myself. This self-concept and this self-awareness in terms of isolation, unrelated to the totality, is the very root of all ill. And when I say all ill, I am saying it in the same sense as the Buddha said, all this is dukkha, suffering, misery, the ill state. All this, he made no exceptions. the wonderful creations of the great artists or the philosophers, the benign kings who did this, that and the other for their states and so on and so on. All our good, as we call it, the relative good which is opposed to the relative evil in our ambivalent condition, he called all of it ill. It happens that he was right. Deadly right. Deadly in a sense which does not strike most people. It is the killer of selfness in us. He was so right. If our minds, our perceptions can really penetrate into that depth, into that selfness, and the real penetration is possible if there is the basis of purity and mindfulness, if we really penetrate, then this poisonous serpent of selfness is no longer the poisonous serpent. He is transformed. This very person is transformed into the enlightening life energy, the center of benediction to all mankind and to the world. But we can't begin to be that unless we awake to the fact that we suffer from this fundamental delusion. If I am good, I shall enter the kingdom of heaven. No. My good is a relative good. I use the term kingdom of heaven, so let us recall the words of Jesus. Why callest thou me good? Only God is good. You see, we look at the words, we say the words, but we have no idea. I'm using the word idea in the sense of we are not at all sensitive enough to the enormous truth of it. And the truth of it is so terrific that if it penetrated us, and each one of us is our own world, it would completely transform this world, oneself, into the kingdom of heaven here now. That is why it is said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. This is the fundamental illusion we must be free of. There is nothing for me. The me represents the separate self. The me represents the bundle of imperfections, of foulness, to use the Buddha's rather strong word, with respect to the body particularly. You see, that is what the me represents. We don't see it. We like to pamper our egos. Like the man in the circus who makes his animal perform something and then puts a lump of sugar into it. We constantly put lumps of sugar into our ego and feed our vanity, our conceit, our illusion. We recall the good things that we have done. the friendliness we showed such and such a person, the steps we took in order that so-and-so's difficulty was removed. We recall all that sort of thing and pamper this fellow, I. You see, you feed the I, make him stronger and stronger. Mephistopheles thrives, he's happy. He'll promise you the kingdoms of the earth because of this. Isn't that one of the great temptations? And it comes in not only Christianity, it comes in the other religions too. It's peculiarly significant that when the Buddha was born and that astrologer came, he who knew the science of the zodiac, which is different from the unhappy meaning astrology has today in the modern world, he who knew the science of the zodiac, Asita, he said, this babe will either be a world-turning monarch, supreme emperor of the world, or he will be the perfected holy one, the enlightened one. But note, either that or this. Perhaps one has to stretch one's imagination a bit. This was a way of suggesting the temptation which in Christianity is put quite straightforwardly, the kingdoms of the earth. So we must wake up to this fact that searching for oneself is the surest way of one of the surest ways of defeating the religious life. All the good within the ambivalent sphere that we do is only a perpetuation and often an intensification of the irreligious state. When you are by yourselves, do think about this very carefully and deeply. What do I mean by nirvana and the kingdom of heaven? And see how much I crave for it. I've done it myself through the years, so I know what I'm talking about. How much I crave for it. Pleasure. Do I ever interpret nirvana or the kingdom of heaven in terms of anything but the pleasing? So think of it carefully. This is how I define it. As something wonderfully happy. No more troubles. No more inner conflicts. For me all the time. Don't forget. We are incorrigibly self-centered. Grasping all the time for ourselves. And to help our considerations along those lines, when you're by yourselves, think of how Sariputta presented nirvana. Nirvana is the extinction of all ill. It is the extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of all illusions. Not a single positive word. What we would call a positive word. And why not? Because in the languages of the world, the positive words which express anything like goodness or advance or progress or fulfillment and so on, are words which are totally self-oriented. Look into the political sphere, the economic sphere, the educational sphere, any sphere you like, and you will find that all advance, progress itself, etc., is in terms of, this is how you will benefit. This is how you will grow. Isn't that so? If it's not so, tell me right now. This is the fact which we have to face. And we never go deeply enough into these facts, because it is too crucial. And what is crucial hurts. So nirvana is the extinction of all these things. And that is the same as the kingdom of heaven. Jesus said, take up thy cross and follow me. Told the other man, sell all thou hast. And the man couldn't do it. Neither the Buddha nor Jesus said, be miserable. Not at all. Far from it. Because that's just a petty little something which lies within the sphere of ambivalence. Just as much as enjoy yourselves, have plenty of pleasure, is also a petty little thing which lies within the sphere of ambivalence. But this kingdom of heaven, this nirvana, completely transcends all that. And in the transcending has no more relationship to either of the duals. So, we have to look into ourselves searchingly, relentlessly. Nothing must stop us. We must move on ineluctably. We cannot be stopped in that movement, in the search for reality. Be in the state of search. Because you cannot postulate reality and then go and look for it. Everything postulated, projected out of the imperfect mind, can be found fairly easily by a good many people. Not all, but by a good many. And it's worth nothing. It turns to dust and ashes afterwards. It belongs to the realm of death, not of life abundant or everlasting. So, consider this matter very, very deeply within yourselves. What is the meaning of living the religious life? Remember also the Buddha's words as they are put in the Mahavagga after the enlightenment. He who doth crush the great conceit, I am. He truly is the blissful one. He said blissful one. But I, reading the words and not yet having crushed that great conceit, the I am, don't know what that bliss is. What do I in my folly try to do? I try to picture the bliss. And say, I shall crush the great I am, and then I shall have that bliss. Lord, what a fool I am. You see how we are caught in this web of delusion. The whole mind, what we call our minds, our psyche and so on, is a tangle of darkness, of illusions, of delusions. We are lost in this labyrinth. And you see, the fate of him who is lost in the labyrinth, the Minotaur, finally eats me up. Every one of us who doesn't, through whom enlightenment is not realized, is eaten up by this Minotaur. That is my death, the wages of sin. Not the death of the me, which is the release into eternal life and fulfillment. You see the difference? Theseus is one who escapes that fate because he's given a thread by which he can find his way back to a starting point. Now that starting point means that one is in the position where the problem arises, shall I take this path or shall I take that path? This is the path of the goddess Athene, Pallas Athene, the goddess of wisdom. Nothing sort of very clever or super intellectual or anything. She stands for temperance, hygiene, prudence, the ordinary crafts, the housewife at home with hers, the house husband in the fields with his. She stands for virtue. She stands for wisdom in the sense of that perfect insight which is just natural to her who was born out of the brain of Zeus, full-fledged. So you see what the goddess Athene represents. It's that path. She stands for living according to the law. I don't mean just in the legal sense. The law, ritta, as in the Rig Veda. That law which means living in tune with the eternal order of things, this inward order, which is embodied in us and brings the body itself into being. And maintains it until my disobedience to that. Disobedience to it necessitates the pain and finally the disruption of the body without realization. A wasted life, an unfulfilled life. I nearly said unfulfilled. An unfulfilled life. Now, what is the other path? It is the path of Circe, the enchantress. She gives you the drugged draft by which you lose all sense of what it means to be a human being. work. It makes you incapable of seeing the purpose of one's own individual existence. It makes you wallow in pleasure under the command of the enchantress. And finally, she touches you with her wand and converts you into a swine. The path of Circe is the path of cunning. It is the path of trying to break the law all along the line, the law of righteous living, and evade the consequences. That cunning which comes to play, to evade the consequences of evil living. It is associated with pills and palliatives and drugs and intoxicants and narcotics and the whole host of them. That is the path of Circe. And doesn't practically all humanity do it? Madly pursuing sensational excitement, the slaves of their passions, their whims, their appetites, caught in the net of their illusions. And then they seek palliatives all along the time, all along the line. They seek ways and means to counteract the ill effects of their own ill, deliberate ill-doing. That is the path of Circe. The other is the path of Athene. So you see, that thread in the labyrinth enables you to go back. But who's going to give you that thread? Have you got an Ariadne? Don't rely upon Ariadne. The only real Ariadne each one of us has is within his own heart. In that every one of us has an inwardness. Some inwardness which is pure, which is the point of transcendence itself, the God within, as people say, or the Buddha within oneself. Look for that. Let the mind be still, and let that tell oneself just what to do. And it will go against all the common drives with which we are plagued. Then it is one's own responsibility either to obey or to disobey. And bear in mind the meaning of the word disobey. The word obey is related to the Latin audire, meaning to listen. And to disobey means not to listen. Whoso does not listen to the perfect, the pure, the divine, the enlightenment that is within oneself is the disobedient one. And the disobedient one is thrown out of Eden. We are all disobedient ones. We are all people who do not listen. Note the way every one of us talks, chatters, constantly interrupting the other speaker. What is all that due to? It's this bundle, the me, throwing itself into the mess, the melee of idle, stupid, senseless chatter. You see why, for instance, in Greece, way back in the school of Pythagoras, the first 2 years, the akoustikoi, they had to keep their mouths absolutely shut. Practice it. For goodness sake, practice it. The modern world needs it more than anybody else. Look at the amount of chatter that goes on everywhere. Politicians, trade unions, the whole lot of them are chattering apes. And what do they bring? Misery. If they'd listen to the other person, truly listen, then they could open their hearts to each other and they can consider together instead of sitting round the table determined to defeat the other. This is merely conquest by words instead of by swords or guns or atom bombs. Isn't it? Look deeply into it. But don't you and I, on the small scale, do it in our own homes? We will not keep quiet. And therefore we are disobedient. We are not listening. Those who try to carry out the teachings regarding mindfulness throughout the day, we believe that we are paying attention to all our physical movements and activities just exactly as you find it stated in the texts, the Pali texts and so on, whether he's standing or sitting or breathing or walking up the stairs or down the stairs, he goes very mindfully, I am now taking a short step, I am now taking a long step or a short breath or a long breath, etc., etc., etc. My dear people, we are going through a mummery. I am taking a short step, a short breath, a long breath, because next week I shall be one stage further, and the week after that another stage further, and in 7 years, 4 months, and 3.5 days, I shall have realized nirvana. No devil, the me, will ever realize nirvana or be able to step into nirvana. I shall be atom-bombed out of existence altogether, annihilated as any matter at all. I shall just be pure radiation with no knowledge of myself after that. I'm speaking very feelingly, I'm sorry, but look, the truth is that which will make us free. And it's not the ideas, the words that I'm putting out, which is the truth. These are intended to be a battering ram, if you like, or an antidepressant, if you like, or something that really wakes you up from lethargy, stupor, this unconscious state and makes you wake up with such terrific energy and wide awakeness that it is actually painful. There is no other way. So, I am paying attention, as I say. Now, I say to you that you are not paying attention. You are fooling yourselves. What is the meaning of attention? Of attentiveness? What actually is attentiveness? We all think we know it. You see, that's why I started by saying we are all caught up in illusions. What do we mean by attentiveness and attention? Now look. When I meet a man for the first time, say somebody is introduced to me, this is Mr. Smith, you see. I say, oh, how do you do, Mr. Smith? I'm very pleased to meet you, and so forth, you see. I go through the normal courtesies, as they are called. How genuine is my feeling towards him? My feeling of welcome. Am I really welcoming him? Or am I like the parrot, you know, who just says certain things according to what the parrot is taught to say? Or do I really feel welcoming towards him? Is it a genuine kindness, a genuine love? I doubt it. Gravely doubt it. 99 cases out of 100, it is humbug. Now, when I see Mr. Smith, I look at his face, I see his body, I get a general impression of him, and in that act of meeting, I have said 12,000 words straight away in this brain of mine. This chattering ape inside here cannot shut up. All my conditioning, all my prejudices, my preconceptions, and if I have been told something about him beforehand, my expectations, my hopes, my desires, all my greed wanting to get this out of him, or, oh, I'll be able to help him this way, which satisfies my ego and my vanity, all that is at work. Make no mistake about it. This is how we live. This is our psychical life. People who become neurotic or suffer from some psychical ailment, go to a psychiatrist to help them. You think it out now. How on earth can any psychiatrist help you out? Really? He can only patch you up a little bit and recirculate you, a worldling, capable of carrying on the world's evil again. Any professional psychologist? So you see, this is how the psyche is working. And I watch him. I'm paying attention to him, to every word that he says, etc., etc. Waiting for the moment when he'll say just those things which will enable me to introduce what I want to say to him and make him sign on the dotted line, an agreement which will bring me in £20,000 profit in 3 months. Look, aren't we all villains that way? If not on the £20,000 scale, at least on the tuppenny scale. Don't we do it? I am a nice, handsome young man looking out, you know, for the pretty girl. Ah, that's the bird that I want. I've learnt that word now. took me 72 years to arrive at that stage. I didn't know it before. You see? That's the one I want. And I behave accordingly. I'm attending to her. Oh, do sit down here. But will you be comfortable there? Etc., etc., etc. Look at all the game. I am attending to her, I say. Is this attentiveness? Is this attention? Or is it grasping? Is it an act of hate because I'm going to possess and dominate the one that has attracted me and who might fulfill my lust, my pleasure, my purposes, etc.? Watch it, really watch it now and pay attention. This is not attention. All my conditioning, all my evil is at play in the act of observing. Nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, purification, mindfulness, meditation, prayer, communion with the Lord, visions of another world. Look at the terrible heap of evil that there is. Now recall the Buddha's words. All this is dukkha, evil. Dukkha, far from the infinite, from the absolute, from God, from Brahman, from reality, from truth, from love, from wisdom. All this is far from it. Without exception. And I call it being attentive. I am not listening. I am disobeying. I am not attending. Now, we have no option but to start like this, as we are. How can you take a step in any direction but from the particular spot on which you are standing? So you see, we have no option about that. I am what I am, I am here, I am this nature, and so forth, and I have to take the next step, as I call it. And the step is the one and only step, which is the totality of the way to realization, to perfection. If I begin to wake up to this, that this is how I am actually behaving, this is the actual thing here present, and I must look at it with a quiet mind. I must see the evil as the evil and the ambivalent opposite, the good, in its limited sphere as the good. I must see that as it is. I must see the false as the false, to use Krishnaji's phrase, Krishnamurti's phrase, and the false in the true, and the truth in the true. It is a case of really awakening to it. Never say that, oh, but you know, I am not clever enough for all that. Cleverness is the one thing that will defeat any saint. You don't want to be clever. You don't want to be tied up in knots. That's the meaning of the word clever. He did a very clever deal, you know. He pulled it off. Successfully tied the other fellow up in knots and downed him, which is the work of hell. So now, you don't need to be clever. Look within. Be awake to the what is. And gradually, we find that our conditioning, all the flaws that are inside ourselves, our prejudices, our preconceptions, our assumptions, every one of which is unwarrantable in the light of truth. This is a terrible absolute statement to make, but it is the fact. Every single assumption that I make, and I can only make assumptions with this brain which functions in the state of ill, not in the state of enlightenment. That is why every one of these is false, is wrong. That is why the absurd assumption that, oh, tread the path, it's all laid down, the teacher will take you, and so forth, you see, and I'll go into nirvana. It's a ghastly assumption. It's nonsensical to the nth degree. To the nth degree for the simple reason that the end point postulated is the infinite, which is the nth degree. So there you are. You see how right I am. We must laugh at ourselves, you know, along the way. Now, gradually all those are seen into. Why? Because you are listening to yourself. You are listening. You are awake. You become aware of what it is. Then you will find, when that process goes on within, that when you meet Mr. Smith, you will be far nearer the reality of meeting a living being as he is in himself. When I see anything, hear anything, touch, taste anything, when I think of anything, when I recall in memory any person or thing or event or so-called truth in a book or whatever it is, do I ever see and know the thing in itself? Never. Immanuel Kant was one of the great Western philosophers who presented all that in a remarkable way in his philosophy. The thing in itself, we don't know. What we do know is the picture in our minds, our mental constructs. And we have talked about this not so very long ago. And our mental constructs are all vitiated by our conditioning and our beliefs and our misconceptions and all the rest of it. So the thing in itself is not seen, not understood, not known. But as one awakes all the time to the fact that, no, this is illusion. It's not so illusory now as 10 weeks ago. The illusions begin to dissipate. And the dissipation of the illusions means not that you're substituting a new idea or thought. Please realize that. But you're getting free of the old thought and not sticking anything in its place. Because whatsoever I stick in its place is an obstruction to the light of truth. You see, every thought, every belief I spin out is an obstruction to truth in this religious sense. Now, this word which I have used, the truth, it has no meaning in the religious. In the religious sense, this word truth has no meaning which is comparable to our ordinary dictionary meanings and our worldly meanings attached to truth. Truth for the mathematician and scientist. Truth for the artist. Truth for the legal man. The truth of history, of geography, etc., etc. All these things apply in their particular contexts quite truly. They are correct there. But they are totally incorrect. The concepts we form, therefore, that truth means so and so, is totally inapplicable to truth in this profound religious sense. So you will say, I'm completely at sea, I just don't know what you're talking about. I can't get anywhere. Of course, I can never get anywhere in that sense. But now look. I can't see the thing in itself through my sense perceptions and through my ordinary intellectual processes and so on, howsoever clever I may be, howsoever much a genius I may be in the worldly sense. Consider now this extraordinary thing. The theists have said, God is omnipotent, is omniscient, all-knowing. And the symbolical statement in the Bible, for instance, not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. You know, if you like to look at that statement, rather matter-of-factly, it's perfectly ridiculous. Has God Almighty no other business but to be bothering about sparrows falling to the ground? But of course they do keep falling to the ground. So what? There's nothing to it. There's a profound inner meaning. God is omniscient. They say of the Buddha, of the great holy ones, that they are omniscient. They say that Brahman, the Absolute, is Sat, Chit, Ananda. Being, consciousness. Chit is consciousness. I always prefer to translate it as complete and total attentiveness. Now note this very carefully. I haven't come across it in the written anywhere. This is something which I have seen for myself. And if I've seen wrongly, I'm under an illusion. But I'll give you the illusion for what it is worth. Chit means attentiveness. Brahman is in the attentive state. God, the Absolute, the Eternal, call it what you like, is in the attentive state. Brahman is being, total being, in the attentive state, ananda, blissful. The word whose meaning we don't know in our worldly condition. Attentiveness. But if Brahman is the absolute all, and if you look at Christian mysticism, Eckhart presents God really, the Godhead and God and so forth, just as the Upanishads have presented Brahman, really, despite what Rudolf Otto has written that there are differences. Of course, there are certain superficial differences as far as the writings go. But the inner spirit is just this, it is the identical thing. Attentiveness for the absolute all. Now do think very carefully. For you and for me, to attend means to attend to something, or to be in a state of expectancy, listening for some sound which will come. But can you be in the state of listening for no sound at all? Can you be in the state of attentiveness, of completely observing, wholly observant, without nothing, without anything to observe? You see, to observe means to see something other than oneself, isn't it? When you observe, you are observing the other. Take the physical example. The eyes are to see with. All right. The one thing that the eyes can never see is just the eyes themselves. The eyes can't even see my face. It happens that having a very long nose, I can see the tip of my nose. But I can't even see my own face. The eyes can never see themselves. So you observe the other. But if God is the absolute all, if Brahman is the totality, there is no other. Because that totality is always presented as a one total reality. If there is no second, how can the one see the one in our sense of the word? Or attend to it? You see? Do you feel not only the mind, but your whole feeling, your whole inner sensitivity must wake up to this. Attentiveness in this supreme religious context means being the thing. You and I, as humans, as mortals, use two words, being and attentiveness. And we use a third word also, bliss, which we needn't concern ourselves with at the moment. But this attentiveness is the actual being it. And it is this being the thing which is knowing the thing in itself. As seeing the thing in itself, as touching the thing in itself, hearing it in itself, thinking it in itself. Look, this is not mere metaphysics. This is supremely metaphysical, if you like, yes. But truth in this sense cannot be spoken about at all except in the most profoundly metaphysical manner. Physical means natural, comes from physis, nature, the Greek physis, physical, you see? In this supremely religious sense, you have to speak metaphysically. So now, this attentiveness means the state where you are the thing itself. Now you might say, but this is a wonderful fancy which you've spun out of your brain. I haven't spun it out of my brain. There have been those through the ages, the few, who have realized, and who have said a word here, a word there, to indicate this. It happens that I am sufficiently interested in it to investigate it to the extent I could. And this is how, at this moment today, I can try and present it to you. That this is attention. The being it. Now you can't be, you and I as we are here, organisms which are independent organisms on their own. We can't be the tree or be the orchestra or something or the music that we are listening to in the material physical sense, in the commoner garden sense. But we can be it in consciousness, can't we? There's nothing to prevent us being that which the senses convey to us in awareness, in total awareness. Now, how and when does that happen? When there is not the slightest vestige of isolative self-consciousness. When it is no longer a case of, I am listening to the symphony. when all, everything that separates the symphony from what is commonly denominated me is out, that means the me, the I, is completely out, then there is no other. There is no second. There is only the one reality, which is now realized in consciousness as the one total absolute unity. And in this state, I am attending. I am attentive. It is this state which is referred to in the Tejo Bindu Upanishad. When the third person of the Trinity, Shiva, who is the supreme ascetic as well as the Lord of reproductive nature, tells his grandson, Kumara the Kartikeya, who asked him to explain the meaning of realizing the Atma. Amongst the many wonderful things he says in that Upanishad, he says, I am the I that has given up I.